our pilgrimage. Pass the time as we're going through our Christian life. The breath that we have, as long as we have it here, we're supposed to pass that time a certain way. And what is that? We're supposed to pass it here in fear. Now, I know that's not real popular in a lot of churches today. I mean, we have people, and this is the time of year, you know, when people are you know, thinking about elves on shelves and, you know, and taking the kids to see Santa Claus and that kind of stuff. And, you know, and they just kind of have the idea that God is a big Santa Claus up in the sky. They, you know, they just kind of look at God and they go, well, it's kind of like going through a cafeteria, you know. Well, I'll take that attribute of God. I really like that love. But I think I'll just leave that justice and that holiness over to the side. And so people treat God that way. I'm amazed at people that I hear when I'm listening to maybe Christians being interviewed. And the total lack of commitment is astounding to me. And so tonight, what I want us to do is I want us to look at these few short verses, and I'm just going to give you four little things and I'll be done tonight. I want you to look with me, first of all, at verse 13. He says, "Wherefore, gird up the loins of your mind." In the last 25 years, I have never, maybe the last 30 years, I have never been able to read this passage of Scripture and not remember a story that was told to me. We had a sweet lady in this church that taught an elderly ladies' Bible class. That class is now taught by Ann Schufert. This lady's name was Eloise Tidwell. And she told me one time, she said, "You know, it bothers me, Brother Tommy, when preachers don't study." And I said, "I agree." And she was serious about studying. You know, her idea of a fun evening was to curl up with her Bible and maybe a good commentary and get ready for her ladies on Sunday. I mean, that was pretty much, you know, things that she enjoyed. She said, many years ago, she said, "I went to hear a preacher preach." And she said he preached a marvelous message out of 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 13. And the title of his message was, "Gird up the lions of your mind." And he preached about, you've got to gird that lion of hatred. And you've got to gird that lion of malice. And you've got to gird that lion of lust. And he just went on. I mean, he was preaching about girding up the lions of your mind. And she said, afterward, I went to him and I said, "Preacher, you might need to reread that verse, because it doesn't say gird up the lions. It says gird up the loins of your mind." And I cannot imagine a time in the last 30 years that I have read this passage and not thought about Miss Tidwell and that story. And so when you look at this, he says, you gird up. Now, what does that mean, gird up? Well, you got to remember how people dressed in biblical times. You know, you didn't go down to the local department store and go over and say, "Well, I think I'll just get a size 38, you know, 30, and everything will be great." I don't wear 38 30s anymore. I wear overalls. That way you can get them as big as you want and give you enough room to move around in them. But you can just imagine how they used to dress. I mean, you've seen television programs. You've seen, you know, movies from that era. People wore robes. And they had around their robe, they had a leather belt. That was called a girdle. They would have an outer tunic, which was like a top coat, not as thick as a top coat, but that's what they would wear. And then they would have some type of headdress. Sometimes it would just be kind of a tallit that would go over their head, and sometimes it was kind of like the one Ahab the Arab wore, all right? It would be a turban. And so they would work in the field, or if someone was a messenger, a herald, they would have to run. Well, can you imagine having an ankle-length robe on and you try to run? Or you go out into the field and you're trying to take care of livestock. You may have to climb over a rock or down into a ravine to get a little baby goat out or some type of little lamb out. No, what they would do is they would gird up to be able to perform those tasks. So what they would do is they would pull their robe up. They would pull it up in front of them and twist it. And then they would take it and they would stuff it under their belt and pull it up. And that way, from their upper thighs down, their legs were free to do basically whatever task was at hand. And so they would gird it up. It was something that was not to be a hindrance to them. And so when he says to gird up the loins of your mind, what that simply means is that there ought to be a discipline in the focus that you have toward the things of the Lord and what you think about. And so he says you gird that up. It has the idea of be decisive about what you're wanting to do. Can you just imagine a shepherd? He's got a little hole that he can hear a little bleeding coming from. And he's thinking, I got to go down in that hole. And so he just decides, well, I'll just go down without girding up my robe. And all of a sudden, what happens to him? He gets tangled up. He may fall and get hurt himself because he was not decisive. He was not disciplined in the way that he went about his business. And you and I need to be disciplined in the way that we go about our Christian life. We need to gird up the loins of our minds. Now, sometimes people say, well, it doesn't really matter what you think about. Sure it does. Everything starts in your mind. Proverbs says, as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. In other words, if you think about something long enough, you're probably going to act on it. And so he says, you gird up the loins of your minds. But then he says something else. He says, you be sober. And so there is not just a girding, but there is a soberness that must be included in this. Now, what does being sober mean? Well, if you were going to take it literally, it would have the idea of not being drunk. But it also carries the idea of someone that has perspective, someone that can have self-control, someone that can take all the facts, put them into a filter, and come out with a good decision. That's what the idea of sober has. I mean, we've all known of people that drank and did stupid things. I heard about a man one time that he told that it was his uncle. And he said, this was many years ago, and he said, my uncle was drunk and he was driving. And he was speeding right through the middle of town. And as he went through town, the local policeman fell in behind him, hit the siren and the lights and pulled him over. And he said, fella, where do you think you're going? He said, I got business in places. And he said, well, I tell you what you're going to get right now. You fix and get a ticket. This was before DUI as it is now. He said, you're going to have to pay a fine. And the old drunk guy said, well, how much is the fine? He said, $10. He reached in his pocket and pulled out a 20. He said, I'm coming back through in 30 minutes. Don't bother me. Well, sometimes drunk people do crazy things. We're not supposed to do crazy things as Christians. We're supposed to be sober. We're supposed to be circumspect in the way that we look at things. We're supposed to be people that are able to control our emotions, to control our actions, to control our tongues. That's who we're supposed to be. And so there is a soberness that's involved in this. But then go back with me to verse 13. And hope to the end for the grace that is to be brought unto you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Can I tell you that there is supposed to be a hope in the heart of every Christian? And do you know how long that hope lasts? That hope lasts until Jesus comes. When you look and it says, at the revelation of Jesus Christ. One of these days, the same Jesus that left Jerusalem, ascended into heaven, he's coming back in the same way. That's what the scriptures say. And so what you've got is, you've got a hope that is supposed to be in us, and because of that, it's supposed to get us to understand we're only here temporarily. We're only pilgrims passing through. There's coming a day when all of this is going by the wayside. All of this is going to be something that is no longer in our sight. We're going to go from earthly to heavenly. We're going to go from an $80 table to an unlimited million and million and millions of dollar tables. That's what we're going to. And so, he says, there's a hope that's there. Well, verse 14, it gives a couple of ways to look at this. The first thing he says, when you're sober and when you're girding up your mind and when you are hoping, he said, you do that as obedient children. Obedient children. I thought it was so funny. And I mentioned it to the little boy's mom. Sunday morning, I was sitting right down here for the program. And of course, we had the caboose here and a couple of the cars over here. And in the second car down here, on the front row, there were three little girls in a row, and then there was one little boy, McCoy Myers. Well, these girls didn't have anything to do at that particular time, so they started just kind of talking with each other. They didn't have a line into play at that point, and so they're just kind of, you know, back and forth with each other. And finally, old McCoy, he reaches over and he goes, and I told his mom that, and she said, he wants people to obey the rules. And I thought, that's good. That's good. Can I tell you that obedience is a good thing? Can I tell you, when my kids were little, if they were obedient, I wanted to give them a whole lot more than I did when they were disobedient. I was thinking the other day about my two oldest. And I remember that when they would fight, I mean, it was rough. And I just wanted to just jerk both of them up and just beat them half to death. I'm like, you're supposed to love your sister and your brother. And they would just fight. I mean, just aggravate. And then when poor Allison came along, I mean, they stuffed her in toy boxes and would sit on it and wouldn't let her out. That kind of stuff. Disobedience was always punished. If you look here, he says, You be as obedient children. Obedient children. What does an obedient child do? Does that mean they're perfect? No. But they'd like to be. They would like to do things to please their folks. You know, I didn't always do everything I was supposed to do. But you know, I never wanted to do anything to intentionally hurt my parents. Now, I did a lot of things when they weren't around. But if I were around them, I tried to, you know, not make them look bad. And so we're told that we're to be obedient children, but then he flips it. Not fashioning. Not shaping ourselves. All right? According to the former lust in your ignorance. Can I tell you how I would describe that last little phrase? When it says, according to the former lust in your ignorance, I would simply say, before you knew better. In other words, there was a time in your life when you just didn't know any better. And if somebody would have said something to you, you'd have said, is that right? All of you can think about things that you didn't know when you first got saved. I bet some of you were, I guess, misunderstanding about things like baptism. All right? We've got a sweet young lady in our church. And about a year ago, I preached about baptism, and I talked about immersion. And evidently, I pronounced it where that she thought, what does that mean? Because her whole life, from the time that she was a little girl, she thought that another name for a pastor, even though she only heard it whenever a baptism was going forward, she thought that a preacher was also called called a merchant. And so she came to me and she said, you have cleared up a whole lot of confusion in my mind today. And she told me what she used to think was this: when she would see somebody baptized and we would say, we're going to baptize you by immersion, she thought they were saying being baptized by a merchant. And so she said, all these times I thought immersion was a merchant. And when I explained what the word meant, it meant to dip under, to plunge all the way under. And the symbol of burial, she said it was like, wow, it's not a merchant, it's immersion. And she has gotten a lot of ribbing about that. And so there are things that you did not know early in the way that you were maybe when you first got saved. If I were to ask some of you, what are some things that you misunderstood? I bet 4 or 5 of you could just stand up right now. You're probably thinking of it right now in your mind, and you're going to go, well, I didn't really know that. Well, we're to fashion ourselves as obedient children, not the way that we were in our former life. There's a lot of things in my former life that I don't need to make my Christian life mirror. My Christian life ought to be different. It ought to be a lot different than it was when I got saved way back in 1972. And so there is a fashioning as obedient children and not according to the former lust. Now in verse 15, he gives us something else that we're to be. There's not just a girding and a soberness and a fashioning, but there's also a living a certain way. There's a living a certain way. Look with me at verse 15. But as he which hath called you is holy. In other words, you've got God. He's a holy God. There's nothing unrighteous about God. One of the attributes of God is holiness. And so, because he, God, which hath called you is holy, so be ye holy in all manner of conversation. Now, the word conversation, it has the idea of your manner of life, the way that you live your life. It's a 1600 word that it's not has to do with you and I talking to each other. It has to do with the way that we live, all right? And so, it's you be holy in all manner of conversation or your living. And so, he goes on to give it a little more authority. And how does he do that? Because of verse 16. And in verse 16, he says, because it is written. Can I tell you that that is all the authority that we need? If it's in the book, it's in the book. It doesn't matter if the whole world stands against it. If it's in the book, it's in the book. And as soon as we get that settled in our minds, when we have girded up our minds, when we have been sober and we're seeing, and we're living, we're living our lives fashioning after being an obedient child, then you move in to this part where there is a holiness, and he said, it is written, be ye holy, for I am holy. In other words, if we have been born of God, the apple doesn't need to fall far from the tree. Now, we have sin nature still. There are times when we get mad. There are times when we lose our cool. There are times when we have evil thoughts. There are times when we say things that we should not say. There are times when we do things we should not do. But every time we do that, if we know the Lord and we're trying to walk with God, there's something on the inside of us, that still small voice called the Holy Spirit. And he convicts when we don't do right. If you don't have any conviction, if there's no guilt for doing wrong, you might ought to check up, because you may not have biblical salvation. Christians walk different. Christians talk different. Christians ought to think different. You and I need to realize that holiness is a big part of the Word of God. And if nobody ever calls for holiness in Christian circles, in my mind, it seems as though that what they're doing is they've got a cafeteria Jesus going on. There's a whole lot about holiness in the Word of God, whether it be Old Testament or New Testament. Now, the passage that he's alluding to is in the book of Leviticus, chapter 11. And if you read that chapter, it'll talk about things like clean animals and unclean animals. And basically the way that you look at that is, if it has a cloven hoof, then it's okay if it chews its cud. If, and if it goes on and how that, you know, you got pigs that are unclean, but goats, sheep, they're clean. Camels, horses, unclean. Certain types of fish, they're okay. Certain types of shellfish, they're out. Thanks. But what you get to is finally you get to this verse. And because he's putting these these restraints on these Old Testament people. He's putting these restraints on them. He says, I want you to do this because it'll make you different than the people that are around you. And you find the people of Israel that did these things. They tried to live by the Levitical law. They were different than all of the heathen that were around them, or the Gentiles that were around them. I'm not saying anything derogatory about the heathen. I mean, that's just somebody without God. And so, in the New Testament, we don't live under the ceremonial law. I thank the Lord for that. And every opportunity I get, I like shrimp. Every time I get a chance, I like to eat thick sliced bacon. I'm not under the law anymore. But just because I'm not in the Old Testament times, there are still certain things that I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to be salt. I'm supposed to be light. And the world is to look at me in my life and say, something different about that guy. And I hope that I live a good enough Christian life where that is said. I want people to be able to look at me one day if I'm laying there in a coffin, which I'm looking forward to going up in the rapture, but if it doesn't happen that way and I'm in a box, and if my wife has it open, I don't want you to walk by and go, well, he sure is handsome, isn't he? What I want you to do is I want you to walk by there and say, you know, he just walked with the Lord. That's what I'd like for them to say. And can I tell you, that's a battle? I mean, that's tough. But I hope that whenever I close my eyes in death, or the Lord comes and I stand before him, he'll be able to say, you lived right. Now, if you've been saved any length of time, you ought to have better decision making than you do when you first get saved. It's wearisome for a preacher when people that have been saved 40, 50 years make some of the statements that they make. You ought to make it an intentional lifestyle to want to be holy. You ought to want to be intentional in girding your mind. You ought to want to be intentional being sober, being able to distinguish things, have good discernment about things. And you have those basically when you get into the book and you learn about it and you say, I won't just know it in my head, I will live it in my life. Ultimately, we only know as much of the Bible as we live. Somebody says, oh, I know that Bible. I had somebody not long ago tell me, oh, I know the Bible as well as you do. 3 or 4 years ago now, we had a young couple that came and joined this church. 2 weeks later, his mother was placed in a hospital in Rockdale County. His father, at one time in his life, considered himself to be a teacher preacher. He was a church man, he said. He'd been saved supposedly for 20 or 30 years. But when his wife got sick, evidently something snapped. And on that particular night, I don't remember if it was a Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, whatever night it was, I got in my truck and I drove down to Covington. I walked into that intensive care unit. I spoke to the young man. He was just sitting there kind of sheepish. His father was sitting over on the other side of the room. And I introduced myself to him. And he looked at me and he said, I want you to know right now, I don't believe nothing you got to say. I said, okay. He said, I know as much of the Bible as you do. I said, wonderful. He said, I used to teach at church. He said, but I don't even know if there's a God right now. If there's a God in heaven, he ought to let me be in that bed instead of my wife. And as he ranted and raved, I just stood there. And I said, I know that this is probably not going to be something that you'll want to hear, but basically you're wrong. God knows exactly what's happening today in this room. And you may not want to participate, but I'd like to at least pray over your wife. From what I understand, she was a praying woman. And we prayed. I say we prayed. Me and the young man prayed. I don't think this guy even closed his eyes. And as I walked out of the hospital that night, getting into my truck and thinking about it on the way home, all I could think about, he used to be a teacher. He used to be strong in his church. But evidently he had a head knowledge and he didn't have a living knowledge. But how long are you to have the hope until the revelation of Jesus Christ? You don't get to say, well, I'll serve the Lord for a year, but I'll check out for the next year and then I'll come back. The Christian life is every day. It's every 24-hour cycle. What does God want? How can I serve the Lord? What's the will of God for me today? What's the will of God for me 10 years from now? Lord, it's all about you. What do you want? And Lord, I'm looking forward to the day when you come back and I've got that hope. As a matter of fact, it's called the blessed hope. And so we're just passing through, folks. We're not going to be living here that much longer. I mean, if God gives me another 20 years, I'll be 83. Now, somebody says, well, these people living to be their 90s. Yeah, some. But all most folks have been promised is 70. That's 70. And so we're just passing through. And there's going to be a whole lot more years until years are done away with once you pass than they are now. So let's make the best of what we got while we got these, okay? Well, I thank you for being here tonight. Let's stand together.